with Arnold Feingold, professor of physics retired, and the first and acting dean of the graduate school at Oyster Bay. I want to start off, Arnie, with the questions that on the second page. If you want, let's see what
everything got through this.
That goes fairly fast.
Yeah. So. All right. I came to Stony Brook in the fall of '60. How old was I? I was 39.
From what institution?
I came from University of Utah, where I was an associate professor of business. With tenure.
With tenure, right. Speak up.
And I came mainly for two reasons. The main one was my family comes from New York. I was born and raised in Brooklyn, and my family lived in New York, so there was a strong tie to the East. And Leonard Eisenbart, who was the chairman of the physics department at that time, was an old friend of mine whom I knew very well. We had both got our PhDs from Princeton, though we did not really overlap there. But after I left Princeton, my first faculty position was at University of Pennsylvania in 1950. And Leonard was at the Bartow Foundation. And he had sort of not an official position at University of Pennsylvania, but a sort of visiting position. He taught some of the graduate courses in the evening. And so we resumed our relationship there, which I just known him slightly at Princeton, but we got to know quite well. And I highly respected him as a physicist. And so when he asked me to come to Stony Brook and told me their vision of the university, I was strongly attracted.
What was it as you understood it then?
Well, the, what was it, the Heald Report?
Yes.
Had just come out at that time, and he quoted to me extensively from the Heald Report that it was the intention, at least in the Heald Commission, and the state, that the state should establish for universities, and their vision was that these should be on a par with the best universities in the nation, the public. Leonard's view was that he saw no reason with Rockefeller's support.
Rockefeller was governor then?
Yes, Rockefeller was governor at that time. And he strongly supported the Heald report, and that they saw no reason why Stony Brook couldn't become the Berkeley of the East, I guess was the phrase. That was bandied about at that time. Well, it takes a long time to build a Berkeley.
Yes.
Comparable institution.
It did in California.
Yes, it surely did. But still, the promise was there, And so that is a very strong attraction. That is to build a full university graduate programs and all. I've been teaching graduate courses ever since I left Princeton, so I was strongly involved with graduate training from the day I arrived at Pennsylvania. I should say after I was at Pennsylvania for 5 years as a faculty, as a instructor and assistant professor. I did not get tenure at Pennsylvania, so I went to Illinois after 5 years, and I was a visiting assistant professor there for 2 years, and then I went to Utah in 57, and as an associate professor of physics, and was there till 60. One of the other reasons why we did really want to leave Utah, our kids were second child was born in Salt Lake City, and we did not relish the thought of having them go through the Utah school system with a strong Mormon pressure on the children. It was just unbearable. Well, the university had none of that, but the university was very fine. The university had a very broad vision on no sectarian viewpoint whatsoever. But the atmosphere for the children was a problem. So, though I must say we made many very fine lasting friendships with people at the university. Great deal of respect for the administrators of the university. One of the main reasons I went there, I guess, was because was the dean of the graduate school there at that time, a very brilliant chemist. Even though he was a Mormon, he clearly was a very, very, very good distinguished
chemist
and a well-drawn chemist. And I knew one of the professors in the department very well before, which is why I went there. So academically, and intellectually, the University of Utah was very fine, but the community did raise some questions, particularly as far as the education of our children. And so those three things I knew Eisenbud well, I had great confidence in him intellectually as a physicist. I believed him about the goals of the institution, and my ties with New York and so on. So the members, I accepted a position.
Did anybody else interview you besides Eisenbud? Did Olson interview you?
I'm trying to remember that. I'm not sure.
Was Lee there at the time that you came, or did he come after?
No, Lee came later.
Lee came later.
All right. Olson was in charge. I may have had a very short meeting with somebody who came through, but I really can't remember.
Right.
My main tie was with Leonard Eisenbud.
Okay. And the year was?
That was 1960. So I came in.
60.
I came in August, I guess. During the summer to get ready for the fall semester. At that time, the school was very small. Of course, it was just the Long Island Center for, what was it called?
Teachers of Science and Mathematics.
Teachers of Science and Mathematics, right. But I was assured that that was strictly temporary and that the mission would change immediately to that of a full university, and that they were hiring with that in mind to recruit faculty for a what would become a major university. At that time, I'm not quite sure. I think the faculty, my recollection is right, numbered about 35 altogether. I think that included all those that came with me, which was a sizable number. So I think I was the only one that came to the physics department that particular year. Including myself, I think there were seven.
Well, let's see.
Seven in faculty. And most of them are still here.
Chris Schwartz.
Chris Schwartz, Herb Meether, Leonard Eisenblatt was the chairman. Now, Herb Meether I had known. He was a fellow graduate student at Princeton. Well, Leonard, since he got his degree at Princeton, mainly recruited from his old acquaintances, and that included a lot of
Well, that's what Olson did.
Yeah, well, of course,
Chicago.
Right. So it's a natural thing to do. So there was Herb Meether, Cliff Schwartz, Dick Moe, who was a fresh PhD from Yale. Everyone else had had experience. I think he made a bad mistake in coming to Stony Brook, because he was a fresh PhD from Yale. He was a student of Marginis. A philosophy of physics.
This is Dick Moe.
Dick Moe, yeah. But coming to a school which was not a university at the time meant that he was not exposed to, what shall we say, the research activities and the wealth of opportunities that are at a university in a big department. Everyone else had been at a somewhere else and knew what a university was. Dick, in a sense, I think that hurt his career for real. And I think that's why. He's never been promoted to a full professor. I think it'll ever be, because he got out of the research. He loved the teaching, which is fine, if that's what you want to do. But, and I think that's why he came. He must have been told a different story. Because he threw himself totally into teaching. But once the mission became to be a university, there was a large emphasis on research, and he just wasn't doing it. It's unfortunate. There's Dave Fox there, who came from Berkeley, and Jim Raz came. I guess Jim Raz came the same time I did. He unfortunately died 5 years later.
I remember.
He's a very bright, young, enthusiastic theoretical physicist, and nuclear physics, so fine. He and I hit it off well, because that was my area, too, and we got some joint research grants almost immediately. So that was nice. So I found that stimulating for my own research.
Your own research was
in theoretical nuclear physics.
Theoretical nuclear physics. Okay.
We got an NSF grant, I think, the following year. I'm not sure. There were seven people there. Eisenberg, Fox, Luther, Swartz, Moore, Harold, Raz, myself.
for?
Principles. And it's interesting that, in retrospect, none of them left. Raz died. Mm-hmm. Eisenberg finally retired. I finally retired. Mm-hmm. The others are still active. So they liked the department, and it was a close department in the sense that they got along, all got along very well with each other. So that was very nice.
Good.
Not true of some of the other departments, but
yeah.
At that time. So anyway, I came with high hopes that this school would soon become a big university, and I think everybody in the physics department certainly shared that view. And the other people I met, of course, since it was a started as a school for training teachers in science, the big departments, there was a departmental structure then, but there was also a kind of divisional structure,
right?
But the vast majority of the faculty were in the sciences, then chemistry, biology, and physics, and mathematics. The humanities and social sciences were essentially what you call service areas at that time. So there are some good people there, I guess. I guess the most distinguished person, I should say, is coming. Was Nelson,
Ben Nelson. In sociology.
In sociology. And I must say, I enjoyed the atmosphere there very much that first year. There's something about a small school that's very attractive if it's growing. Small enough so you know everybody.
Right.
We used to eat in the cafeteria, which was the old Staples. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Do you remember that?
I sure do.
And that was marvelous because we'd share a table with the biologists, the chemists, the mathematicians, and the few, and occasionally a few humanities and social science people. And so you get to know what everybody in the school was doing. I must say, I miss that in the later years. It's very hard to keep a Catholic interest in the whole university when you have large departments.
Right.
It's probably the main price you pay.
The separate structures, the large structures, tend to condition association.
Well, one can have close relations only with a limited number of people, and if you have a large department, it tends to be limited to that department.
Yes. Well, we're making an effort now to reestablish the luncheon.
A good faculty club would be very nice.
Right. Okay. What were your impressions of Stony Brook when you first came, the campus, the people, the leadership, the spirit? That's number 8.
Well, of course, the campus was beautiful. no question about it. I much regretted the move here.
Yes.
And I think everybody there did it. It's just such a beautiful grounds for that. It's once a vision of what academia should be.
Yeah.
So, of course, we had no say in that.
Well, it couldn't.
Not under the restrictions that were imposed. The land was too small, really, but and the grounds had to be preserved, so that it was unfortunate. It would have been much better if they had just expanded the area there somehow. And being closer to New York would have been a tremendous We recruited after that by telling people, well, we're just outside of New York City, but... And it is true, you can get to New York in those days in an hour if you went at the right time of day. But 60 miles is a good deal different than 30 miles.
Right.
And that was one of the main attractions we had in trying to get back to New York, that we were in New York City. With all its cultural and intellectual opportunities. The people, as I said, most of the people I was thrown in with as soon as I came, I had the same vision of the institution that I had, that I'd been told by Leonard. One of my most precious documents was the heel.
Did you throw that out?
I'm afraid so. I got to do that. I hope you have a copy of it.
Yes,
it must
we
be
do. We do. We could use a couple more.
And everyone in chemistry and in physics surely share that same view of a major university, a la the big state universities. I mean, that was my background, in essence. Pennsylvania is a quasi-state university. Technically private, but it is fundamental state almost entirely. And it ran as a state university. And then I was at Illinois, big state university. Utah, a little smaller, but still, as far as the state was concerned, a big university. And my graduate work was at Princeton, which is a big university, at least as far as graduate work goes. And I did my undergraduate work at Brooklyn College, which is a big public university. So I was completely, much more saying, public university oriented.
Was Harry Giddens at Brooklyn College when you were there?
Yes, he came in while I was an undergraduate, the latter part, after the stormy late 30s. I didn't like him. He was much too conservative for me. He was the most of the undergraduates at the time, but I did get to appreciate him.
All right.
But it soon became clear after I'd been there a very short while that there were people at the campus who didn't share my view of what the institution had become. There was this a big argument about how to organize the undergraduate curriculum a la the University of Chicago undergraduate school, the 100 Books program, they're bringing up Annapolis. Not is it Annapolis, but
St. John's.
Annapolis.
Yes.
As their ideal of an undergraduate institution, there were people, particularly. We had long discussions with people in the biology department who felt quite differently. Earth clearly had different views.
What were
the chairman of
what
the
were
biology department?
Earth's views?
I'm not so sure I ever discussed them with him in great detail, but with the people in the department, in the biology department, we shared them. And from reminiscences and from talks with the people in the physics department who were there earlier, who came in 57, they came in 57, 58. It was the feeling that any faculty member could teach any undergraduate course. Because after all, an undergraduate course is at a low level, and one would think that a faculty member would have knowledge of the rudiments of every subject, at least of the first 2 years, say, of undergraduate instruction. So the curriculum was organized around broad subjects rather than around disciplines. As I said, this was just going out when I came. But they taught a course where the eye was the focus of the semester's course, and after all, the eye involves physics. Topic.
And this is biology?
No, this is general.
General.
So, in teaching the eye, you would teach biology, physics, chemistry, all of the sciences involved. And that any faculty member in the sciences could do that. Teach the optics, teach the chemistry, teach the biology. My background was from schools where the faculty were organized into disciplines,
right,
and not a broad a basis where any faculty member felt he could teach. I resist teaching a freshman course in chemistry, for example, or a freshman course in biology. Not that I hadn't had courses at that level, but I didn't have the advanced information, which I felt was essential if one wanted to really teach the elements of a subject properly. One has to know a great deal more than the elements. So there was that argument, but, and that went by the wayside fairly fast. Physics department refused to participate in that, at least when I came here. Yeah. And we insisted that we had a more conventional structure. So there was this division, I guess, between what you might call the conventional structure, which we in the physics department felt strongly about, as the subject matter that the students learn should be in the individual disciplines, as opposed to a sort of overall mix that the people from Chicago felt was appropriate. And that kept coming up, but also there was, it quickly became evident that there was a strong division about what the goals of the institution should be. It was clear that a sizable portion of the faculty did not adhere to this big state university concept, a la Midwestern state, and their vision was more of a small undergraduate college, really.
Liberal arts
college. An elite
college.
Liberal arts college.
And that was that became evident in the early planning of the buildings. The library, the size of the library, for instance.
Well, I don't know whether that controlled it. It was just that the you couldn't get permission to build buildings much larger to accommodate a student body, very much larger than the present one. You know, you can make
right.
You can make enrollment plans for the future, but they won't accept anything beyond the next 3 or 4 years. Even though the buildings plan to last for 20 or 30 years or more.
Right.
So that is a serious thing.
problem.
But the main problem was this philosophy of a liberal arts, essentially undergraduate college, versus a discipline-oriented, research-oriented, graduate-oriented, large state institution. And it was clear that many of the faculty had been recruited on the basis of it being a liberal arts college, which I found astounding, because I had been told exactly the opposite.
Yeah.
It was clear that people in biology had mainly been recruited on the idea that it would be a liberal arts college. Eric was giving his people a different story than Eisenbud and Bonner were giving their people.
Yes.
And that was most unfortunate. You have people come to an institution who come for reasons of what the goals of the institution are, and then find that that's not shared by the administration or by other faculty members who have had a different story. That was very, very unfortunate. And that was the real crux of the difficulty.
So essentially it was an ideological split over the nature of the right. curriculum and the nature of the institution.
Oh, yes.
Right. Well, now let's see. You say Lee had not arrived when you...
No, Lee came... Lee was hired in... at the end of 60.
Spring of 61 or something?
Either the winter of 60, December or January, at that time.
Yeah.
And I don't know when he officially took over. Whether it was a January semester or whether it was officially in July. I think it was actually in July that I met him. Mm-hmm. He's thinking about that. But he did give a speech in the early spring to the faculty. And he just quoted the Hill Report, which is what he had been told was the mission of the university. And I would say half the present faculty at that time were astounded that was not what they had been told. He had no conception that a large portion of the faculty had a different vision of the institution and felt that they'd been sold down the river. He was never informed about this, which was very unfortunate. Now, of course, what he said, I wholeheartedly support him because that was the vision that I had come to the institution. And when the faculty heard that, we had already had strong debates at the faculty meetings about how the curriculum should be organized and what the goals of the institution were. But that speech of his really caused things to, what I say, crystallize into two opposing camps. And he was completely ignorant of that. I felt the people in Albany had... Well, he was guilty in part, too. One shouldn't take a job like that without talking with many of the faculty before accepting it. You shouldn't talk just with people that are hiring you. But I thought the people in Albany had let it down.
Now, are the people in Albany, what individuals come to mind?
Well, I wouldn't know. Hamilton, of course, was the... the chancellor or the president, whatever they call it.
They called him president.
President, I guess, yeah. Hamilton and Porter, I guess, would be his right-hand man. And they essentially would be the people at least to my knowledge.
We're running State University of New York. Now, Porter's background, of course, was a small college, so that's excusable in a way.
President of Fredonia. He had been president of Fredonia. His field was history.
Yeah. But Hamilton should have known better.
He came from Michigan State.
He came from Michigan State, right. And he should have known better. He came from a big Midwestern university. Maybe he got sand trapped too. I don't know. And by the fact that he came from a big state university, that's the way he envisioned the institution should be too, until he learned otherwise. But it's true that the other people outside of Hamilton were all teachers' college on a small liberal arts college background.
Reuben Froden. Does that mean anything to him? Carlson, does that mean anything to him?
No.
I think he was the predecessor of Hamilton.
But anyway, Lee clearly came with the vision that it would be exactly what the Hill Commission said it would be, a major university center a la the Midwestern.
Well, was that the view of the central administration in Albany?
Well, that's what Lee was told. That was clear, and that's what the Hill report said. I don't think that was. It may have been Hamilton's vision. I have no idea. It clearly was not Porter's vision.
Yes.
Well, the vision, accentuated with the very first things that Lee did. He was following what he felt was the mission of the school. To build it into a major university. He did not like the Chicago structure for the undergraduate school. He did not like the divisional structure. He felt that to get academic excellence, one had to have strong individual departments. So one of the first things he did was abolish the divisional structure. Now, the divisions were run by people who were committed to the liberal arts structure. That was Bill Lester, who was the divisional chief for the physical sciences and mathematics. Erk had a divisional title or not, I'm not sure. It's hard for me to see biology being a separate division about something, but maybe it was. Who was in charge of humanities and social science? Was it Williams or Ziskind or one of those people?
Ziskind was in philosophy. What about...
Ziskind was in philosophy. Sternfeld was also in philosophy. Williams, I guess.
George Williams?
No.
You mean... Williams was in political science.
I think he was... I may be wrong, but I think he was in charge of the social... But anyway, those people, along with... Olson clearly wanted it to be a liberal arts college.
Yes.
And, of course, was very upset when they brought in Lee. Clearly was disappointed that he wasn't selected as the, call it then, those days, the chief executive officer. It was no title of president. It was
chief administrative officer.
Chief administrative officer. But anyway, he was clearly disappointed. But his vision of the school was clearly completely contrary to that of Lee, and that may have been the main source of their anger between the two. The Alistair Division Chiefs, of course, for many reasons, felt that they had been unfairly treated. So that led to a great deal of trouble. Fundamentally, it was this question of what the goals of the institution would be. Is it going to be a university, a la Illinois, Berkeley, Wisconsin, which is what we in the physical sciences felt.
Those
the mission.
Those were the models for a state university
right.
at the time, and they were highly respectable models.
Yes. Now, of course, and one can say that's conventional, and a new institution has the opportunity to be unconventional and innovative. So one can see that perhaps one should change, but it's a good time to change if one wants to change from the customary. The school is one of the places growing. But I think the real reason was, as I said, this question between a liberal arts school and a graduate-oriented
institution.
So I think they would say it was more on the basis of educational philosophy, after all. Undergraduate Chicago is just part of a full university.
Now, as I understand it, there was some occasion. Who appointed you dean of the graduate?
Well, that happened. That happened in the summer. And I say I'm vague whether Lee was officially president at that time or not. I don't know whether the program started in January or in July or anyway. But he felt that since the mission of the institution had now changed from an undergraduate institution to that of a full university, that it was very important to organize the school a la a typical state university. Let's take it in Western institution, because the Eastern state universities were not the models that we were following. They were small institutions.
Cornell was not.
Cornell's not a state university. It's a private institution.
Yes, that's right. It's private. But it has the contract colleges.
Cornell is it's a semi-state institution, as the University of Pennsylvania is in that sense. It's supported by its contract colleges. This is University of Pennsylvania supported by its medical funds. actually, Pennsylvania got money from the state for its undergraduate program, because they had some arrangement where they had to admit so many students from each district of Philadelphia. So they did get state support that way. Cornell just got into that contract. And, of course, we felt that at least those in physical sciences felt that should become a big university. Of the stature of the big
Big Ten.
Respected. Mm-hmm. Of the better of the Big Ten.
Better, all right. Better of the Big Ten. All right.
After all, New York State at that time was the wealthiest state in the Union at the time. It isn't very long, perhaps. Glass at the time,
We had strong reservations about 4 state universities. Of course, that's up to each center to vie to see which one can become, what is the phrase, the crown jewel.
Yeah.
And we thought we had a head start over the other centers because we essentially were starting from scratch. Buffalo had a large built-in faculty, semi-medium, some 50, but a lot of undistinguished faculty. And we had a chance to build from the ground up. The Albany again, Teachers College before and again,
yeah.
So it had trouble. It had trouble developing. We thought we had an easier time.
That's right. That's right.
To a different mold. Except, of course, for this core of faculty who had come in with a different vision.
Right. Right.
Now, so what Lee did, he thought he had the whole faculty behind him.
He did.
He did. Nobody
told
him otherwise.
Nobody
told him otherwise. And so he immediately went ahead as a sign of it becoming a university. He got approval for the engineering college, so he brought Tom Irvine and Bill Snyder.
Bob Snyder?
No, Bill.
Bill.
Bill Snyder.
And
he left after after about 10 years, from who were associated with Lee at North Carolina.
Robert.
And Snyder and Irvine were clearly top engineers, I mean, with internet.